This is Radio Times. Welcome. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off. We'll be talking about a number of headline news stories this hour, including recent protests in Russia and changes in U.S. strategy toward ISIS in Iraq. But first, President Trump on Tuesday stuck to his promise to try to undo much of President Obama's climate change policy by signing what's been dubbed an Energy Independence Executive Order. The ceremony was held at the Environmental Protection Agency, and Mr. Trump put pen to paper as coal miners looked on. One of the goals of this executive order is to restore thousands of jobs to the coal industry. Another is to reduce dependence on foreign fuel imports. So what does this mean to initiatives to combat climate change like the Paris Accord? And can the Trump administration revive the struggling coal industry in this country? If you'd like to join the conversation, send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Promise we'll try to get to some of those this hour. Robinson Meyer is associate editor at The Atlantic. Nice to have you with us, Rob.
Hey, thanks for having me. I grew up listening to the show, so I'm excited to be on.
Oh, that's terrific. Well, listen, this executive order directs the EPA to begin dismantling President Obama's signature effort to combat climate change, and that is, of course, the Clean Power Plan, which, incidentally, was never implemented. It's been in a Supreme Court-induced limbo. But Rob, if it had been allowed to go into effect, the Clean Power Plan would have done what?
It would have guided states and their state utility boards to begin moving their electricity factory fleet from coal to natural gas and renewable sources and hydroelectrics. It had a variety of mechanisms to do that. There were some ways that you could not really retire your coal plant, but essentially buy credits in other states' renewable fleets. And overall, it would have reduced carbon emissions from the utility sector, from the power sector, by 32% by 2030 below 2005 levels, which is the peak of U.S. carbon emissions. So it would have prevented about 1.5 billion tons of carbon dioxide from being emitted into the atmosphere.
So the EPA during the Obama administration said there would be tangible public health benefits to this as well.
That's right. And in fact, the American Lung Association was out yesterday saying that they're going to oppose this legally however they can. Because coal plants are dirty, they don't just emit carbon dioxide, but they emit mercury. They emit a lot of ozone and particulate matter, and all those have respiratory effects. They cause increased morbidity, asthma attacks, heart attacks, cardiovascular problems. So when you move coal fleets kind of out of the electricity fleet for the United States, those emissions go down of all those conventional pollutants and public health outcomes go up.
So Rob, let's talk about legalities. Will it be easy or relatively tough for the Trump administration, EPA, to undo the Clean Power Plan?
It's a good question, and we don't exactly know. So there's now going to be this two-year-long process or some years-long process where the EPA goes in and examines all the science again and all the policy again and evidently tries to weaken the rules, given that that's what President Trump asked them to do. The Supreme Court has said that the EPA has to regulate carbon dioxide because it's a pollutant that's harmful to public health. In fact, the Supreme Court has like laid out all the legal case for the EPA to regulate carbon dioxide, but it has not approved a plan. The EPA will have to come back with a plan at the end of this two-year process that is at least as good as the Clean Power Plan at restricting carbon dioxide. At least that's kind of what the sum of court cases about this issue so far has revealed. We don't know how they're going to do that.
Yeah, I was going to say, will this EPA have the will to do so?
The EPA is staffed by people who understand climate change, and it's staffed by people who care about this issue. You know, they wouldn't be working at the EPA if they didn't feel that way. The bureaucracy does have a lot of power to kind of feed answers back up to the political appointees and to insert things into the administrative record that say essentially, we don't know how you want us to do this. We think this is impossible. You know, we don't see a way to legally create a plan like this. So we don't know how this comes out. And there's an there's a solution here for Trump where this never really comes out, where if he and Scott Pruitt, the new administrator of the agency, can find a way to string the rules along for 4 years and tell environmental advocates and the courts that they're just on the verge of putting out a plan or that they need another 6 months, they could just delay regulation of carbon dioxide for 4 or 8 years. Hmm. And it would never really come to a head. They just – all they want to do is delay it, and they would be successful essentially just by doing what they did yesterday.
Well, how does this all work in with the Paris climate change? There was nothing said about this on Tuesday. And if you would, for just a moment, Rob, remind us of what the Paris Accord attempts to achieve.
So the Paris Accord attempts to achieve it attempts to prevent 2 degrees of global warming, like that global mean temperatures would rise by 2 degrees. And to do that, after 21 years of the countries of the international community getting together and failing to find a binding agreement to deal with climate change, instead it's a non-binding agreement essentially for the biggest polluters. It says, make us a promise. It's a voluntary promise. There's no legal punishment for not meeting it. We're all going to make voluntary promises to each other, and then we're going to meet back again every 5 or 4 years and revisit those promises and hopefully tighten them down.
Toothless tiger.
I mean, it's it does seem to work. Like it what it's meant to do is tell kind of like banks and financial investors that they should stop investing in fossil fuels because there will be less government support for that over time globally, and should start plowing that money into renewables. And to some degree that was already happening, and to some degree, you know, it does seem like it helped. But this executive order yesterday very pointedly did not mention Paris at all. The White House was clear that they have not come to a decision about Paris yet. What it does mean is that without these rules, the U.S. will have a really hard time meeting its voluntary commitment under Paris. And so it's possible we could see a world where the Trump administration stays like a party to the treaty, but doesn't do anything to meet its promise that it made under the treaty.
And just as a quick aside, Rob, we're hearing that the president's daughter, Ivanka, and her husband perhaps were in favor of Mr. Trump staying with the Paris Accord. Anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny. This does seem to be a place where you can see the outward consequences of the parlor games that get played about like White House power and who has it. And there's a lot of criminology involved with the Trump administration. From what we know, Ivanka is somewhat concerned, and Jared are somewhat concerned about climate change. They have a lot of progressive friends in New York, reportedly, who are lobbying them on the issue.
Yeah. And
they have young children. That's true. And Rex Tillerson, you know, the former CEO of Exxon and, you know, our current Secretary of State, also has said he wants to stay in the agreement. Although you could argue that the U.S. will have more power over weakening the agreement by staying in it than by just leaving it altogether. And those could be some of his rationales. But it does seem like, you know, Ivanka brought Al Gore to the Trump Tower back during the transition period. And so it does seem like they at least care about getting good PR on the issue.
Yeah.
And that could, you know, that could, if that's good enough to keep us in. Okay.
We'll take it, right? Well, let me just we only have a few minutes left, and I do want to get to the coal industry. It faces enormous challenges. President Trump wants to put coal miners back to work. What, in effect, does happen under this executive order?
So this executive order does remove a lot of the incoming regulatory regime that had not gone into effect that would have affected American coal power plants. And a lot of conservatives, a lot of people in the energy, in the coal industry specifically, argue that that was a major obstacle to full employment in the coal industry. But what's happening across the whole utilities market, and what utility providers will tell you, and even what the CEOs of some coal companies will tell you, is that natural gas, it's cheap natural gas made possible by fracking, that is putting coal miners out of business, and that is making electricity fleets and power companies retire their coal power plants or switch them to natural gas. And so I haven't seen a energy expert who thinks that this will revive the coal industry. I think there is disagreement about whether it will significantly stem the bleeding, like whether the kind of losses will flatline or whether it'll just continue to decay, because investors and companies are going to assume that no matter what happens in this 4 to 8 year period, eventually there will be carbon regulation, and eventually coal will just not be economical as a source of electricity.
President Trump's executive order also affects something called the social cost of carbon. What is that, Rob?
Yeah, so the social cost of carbon is basically an actuarial estimate that says, what is the cost to the planet? Like, what is the cost to the future society of the planet of every additional ton of carbon dioxide that we emit today? And right now, there's been a lot of calculations, and the Obama administration said for every ton of carbon we emit, it costs human society $37. There are researchers at Stanford who say that number is closer to $200, but the Trump administration is probably going to come in and tell the government, tell the people who calculate that they only want it to affect the U.S. and that they want them to use a different formula for inflation and how costs decay over time. It gets technical really fast. But they think that it will bring it down to like $5 or $6 per ton.
So Rob, how did environmental groups react on Tuesday to the expected announcement of this executive order by Mr. Trump?
Yeah, it was funny. I was talking to folks who do advocacy on this, and they all said, this is what we expected since November 9th. Since Trump won, we knew we were going to get a big executive action on this. This is maybe a little more sweeping than they thought. It's a little less sweeping because of Paris. And yet, it's still really devastating to them. And everyone was surprised by how sad they were to see these things go. Every environmental group said this is just a huge setback for U.S. climate action. You know, I saw someone compare it to a sledgehammer.
Yeah. Well, what do you expect them to do next?
So they do have a number of ways that they can sue to prevent this from going on further. So the Trump administration is going to withdraw. The Clean Power Plan is currently in court. It's was sued by a lot of coal states, including Scott Pruitt, who now runs the agency. The Trump administration will probably try to withdraw that lawsuit, and then immediately environmental groups and Democratic-controlled states, for the large part, will move to block that withdrawal and try to get the court to say that the plan is legal before it's too late.
Well, stay tuned, right? Thanks,
yep,
Rob.
That's right.
Rob
Absolutely,
Meyer.
Thank you.
Rob Meyer is associate editor for The Atlantic. We appreciate you joining us, Rob.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. The Guardian's Alec Loon is next. He was arrested at one of the anti-corruption protests that took place in Russia over the weekend. More of Radio Times just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's got the day off. Russia made headlines this past weekend as thousands of protesters took part in dozens of demonstrations in cities and towns across the country. The gatherings were demonstrating against government corruption. Hundreds of people were arrested. Alex Loon is an American reporter for The Guardian who was in Moscow at the time of the march, and he was arrested as well, along with many others. He was also later released and joins us now to tell us about what happened from the perspective of from somebody who experienced this firsthand. And also, he's here to tell us about the anti-corruption movement in Russia. Alex Loon, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi there. Good to be here.
So to the marches. The one in Moscow was organized by Alexei Navalny, who Alex, might be safely described as a thorn in Vladimir Putin's side. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he's announced his intention to run in the presidential election next year. Putin, of course, is also expected to run for his fourth term. So that's put the two of them on a collision course. Navalny, we recently saw an old trial against him, an old conviction against him, but reopened. It was sent for a retrial, and he was given a suspended sentence. This is for an embezzlement charge that has been going on for years and that a lot of people have described as very politicized. It was first brought up against Navalny when he started to make waves as an anti-corruption and opposition leader. So now he has this conviction on him. The authorities say that he can't run for president, but Navalny is arguing that the Constitution gives him the right to run because it's only a suspended sentence, not an actual sentence in prison. So he's campaigning around the country as a presidential candidate and bringing people out to rallies. That, of course, is making the authorities here very nervous.
So Alec Loon, tell us a little bit about an investigative video, this investigative video done by Navalny and his Anti-Corruption Foundation, which made a huge splash. It was, viewed by millions on YouTube, went viral?
That's right. A few weeks ago, Navalny released a big investigation he had done. He's done a lot of these investigations, kind of following, finding documents and finding out kind of what official owns, what luxurious real estate, where. But this is the first time he shot this high. He did an investigation of Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev, in which he found that Medvedev had secretly amassed a whole network of properties, all sorts of mansions, country estates in Russia, and even a vineyard in Italy. Was the finding. And Navalny didn't just release this as an investigation on paper, but also did a video about it, and the YouTube video went viral. It was viewed at least 11 million times before Saturday's protest, and that was one of the main catalysts for the protest on Saturday, which was targeted against Medvedev. The protest was to demand answers to these allegations, because Medvedev and his spokeswoman have refused to address the allegations, saying that they won't address any allegations made by a convicted person, referring to Navalny, of course.
Yeah. And noteworthy, Alec, there were a lot of young people present in these protests. Is that a little bit different than perhaps protests of years past, recent years?
Yeah. I was here in 2011 and 2012. And I was covering then the street protest movement that was sparked by electoral fraud during the congressional elections here. And at that time, you know, there were a lot of kind of old guard opposition leaders, guys who had served in the parliament here, a lot of old familiar faces. Since 2012, so much has changed. The annexation of Crimea, a boost in patriotism. One of these old guard opposition members, Boris Nemtsov, was gunned down outside the Kremlin. So much has changed, and everybody kind of thought that this street protest movement had died out for the time being. And suddenly on Sunday, thousands of people came out in dozens of cities around Russia, and there weren't these old guard opposition leaders, but there were a lot of younger kids who probably weren't taking part, who were too young to be taking part in these protests in years past. And, you know, I just as a little anecdote, I remember sitting in the police van and one of the guys in there with me was asking, did I think that he was going to get kicked out of university for being arrested at a protest? There was even a 15-year-old in the van with us. So a very young crowd, and that certainly is kind of a new block of people that we haven't seen expressing any sort of political activity previously.
Well, we're going to talk about that as it might relate to the presidential election, which I believe is next year. But let's get to your experience, Alec. So you found yourself arrested. What was going through your mind at the time? What did you think might happen to you?
I thought I was just going to be released as soon as I explained that I was a journalist. I had been... as soon as Navalny showed up at the protest, he was detained and put in a police van. And people had just been walking up and down Moscow's main street quietly, not really chanting anything, without signs, because it was an unsanctioned protest. So people just came out as if they were just going for a walk. But, of course, there were thousands upon thousands of them. So as soon as Navalny showed up, they arrested him and put him in a police van. The police van turned down a side street, and riot police were, and a lot of people followed after the van, and they started chanting, "Let him go." At this point, riot police were pushing people out of the way. They were even lifting parked cars and pushing the parked cars out of the way to clear a route down this narrow side street for this van, just so they could get Navalny out, get him to a police station, and avoid things escalating. I followed the crowd. Eventually, the police van drove off. The crowd went back to the main street, but I stayed there. I was interviewing one man who said that police had kicked his feet out from under him in the confusion. And so I was just standing there interviewing him, and all of a sudden, the riot police around us, one of them yelled, "Let's get to work." And all of a sudden, they started detaining people. And I turned around and looked at my phone to take a picture of them suddenly detaining these people. And at that point, I was grabbed by a riot policeman and bustled off to a police van that was waiting. And I was saying, as soon as he grabbed me, I was saying, I'm a foreign journalist. In Russian, and that made no impact. Once I was put in the police van, I was showing them my documents, saying, "Look here, I have an accreditation. I'm here working. I have the right to be here and cover this protest." And that made no impact on them. I thought it was all just a misunderstanding, and I'd be let out. But in the end, they ended up driving me around in the police van and taking me to the police station. And I spent about 5.5 hours in police custody. And at the end, I was charged with an administrative violation of holding an unsanctioned rally.
Yeah, and you say the charges filed against many of those in your group are dubious at best.
Yeah, the charges, I mean, first off, I mean, how could they tell who was participating in the rally and who wasn't? I, for one, was not participating. I was covering it, and I have the foreign ministry accreditation that says that I can do that. A lot of people, for instance, one young woman who appeared on the cover of a lot of publications the next day, there was a picture of her being carried off by riot policemen. She says that she had just gone to McDonald's to meet her mother and her sister. One man who was in my police van later told me that he had just been walking down the street when he saw all these people marching, and he went to see what was going on, and he saw police detaining a man very roughly, so he started yelling at them, "Shame, shame," because they were detaining this man so roughly. And when he did that, they detained him and also hit him twice, he said, when they were detaining him. So he said that this time he didn't come to participate in the rally, but the next time he would come to participate just because of the way he was treated.
So, Alec Loon, let's get back to the video that went viral, the video done by Navalny, which really posted Prime Minister Medvedev, and it's been viewed by millions on YouTube. You have a lot of youth in these protests across the country. What has been the reaction from the Kremlin to this?
Well, that's been pretty interesting as well. The next day, we had Vladimir Putin's spokesman telling us that the opposition was manipulating children, taking kids, putting them in harm's way at these unsanctioned rallies. Allegations were also being made in pro-Kremlin media that the protesters were paid to come out. And so, a lot of kind of portraying this as some sort of nefarious plot to brainwash and harm the youth, when in fact it was the authorities who refused to sanction the rally in a timely manner and didn't really offer a reasonable alternative to where it was supposed to be taking place. I mean, also to note, there have been rallies in the past that turned a bit violent, but this one was totally peaceful.
Yeah.
People were literally just walking up and down the street in a counterclockwise direction.
Many of them carrying rubber ducks? What was that about?
Yeah, some of them were carrying rubber ducks. Some of them were even had pairs of sneakers around their necks. The rubber ducks and sneakers, that's just a reference to the video with Medvedev. One of the findings that Navalny had was that Medvedev purchased through a front company. Medvedev had purchased lots of clothing, including 20 pairs of sneakers in only 3 months. So And then, of course, in the investigation, they were showing photos in the Navalny's, photos of Medvedev in these sneakers, in these new sneakers that he had purchased. So it was quite funny, kind of this, just because Medvedev is known as kind of a flashy dresser who kind of wears these really bright, sometimes a little bit ridiculous outfits.
Yeah. Well, Alec, we've got a question from a listener who wants to know, what was the sense of how many people were protesting? Let's look at Moscow. Hundreds, thousands?
Oh, well, no, I mean, it's so hard to tell, of course, just because this wasn't in one place. This was all up and down Moscow's main street, very kind of long stretch of road, and people were constantly walking up and down. So even the groups that normally count the attendance at opposition protests weren't counting because it was just an impossible thing to count.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can say with confidence that this was the largest unsanctioned rally that I have seen in Russia since 2011. Mm-hmm. There were thousands of people there. I would not be surprised if there was more than 10,000 people that took part.
People who oppose Vladimir Putin, his administration, his policies, sometimes somehow end up dead. You know, the journalist 10 years ago when she criticized the war in Chechnya was shot. Alexander Litvinenko, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, you know, the former Russian agent who was poisoned by a lethal dose of radioactive polonium. You have to wonder if Alexei Navalny at times feared for his safety. And that's a question that doesn't necessarily need a journalistic answer. Just as an observer, Alec Loon, what do you think?
Sorry, just the last part of that. Do I think that Navalny's in danger?
Well, you have to wonder if he fears for his safety.
Sorry, one more time?
Not necessarily whether he is actually in danger, but whether Mr. Navalny fears for his own life, fears for his own safety. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, Navalny has been completely brazen in the face of so much persecution, most of it through the legal system. He's been put under house arrest. He's been kept in jail. He's been constantly hounded with these political trials. And yet he seems to have so much bravado in the face of that. And I think what gives him that confidence and that bravado is the fact that he's become such a well-known figure. He's been doing these investigations, these corruption investigations for a long time. And the Medvedev one is not it's been the biggest one, but it's not the only one that's gone viral. A lot of these investigations got a lot of attention. When he was leading the street protests in 2011, 2012, he got a lot of attention. You know, he's fairly well known for a person who is not given any coverage on state television and whose last name to this day will not be said by Putin or Putin's spokesman or almost by any official, even when they're discussing him. They'll just refer to him as that convicted person. We know who we're talking about. They won't say his name even. And despite all of that, Navalny has a huge influence and outreach and name recognition among Russians. And I think that he realizes that were anything too dire to happen, if anything really bad was to happen to him now, most people would be able to connect the dots and see that it wasn't just a coincidence. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, it takes a lot of bravery, of course, to do what he's doing and what other opposition activists are doing, and for that matter, what thousands of people did on Sunday when they came out to an unsanctioned protest. Speaking to the people in the police van with me, I mean, these were people who were just ordinary people who they will now all face, at the very least, administrative charges. At the most, they will face a little bit of jail time, fines. So, of course, yeah, they're the risk that they put themselves at to speak up for what they believe in is not to be underestimated either.
So, Alec, as a journalist and observer, do you think Navalny stands a chance to wrest the Russian presidency from Vladimir Putin? I mean, Putin still enjoys a decent approval ratings from the Russian people, correct?
Yeah, Putin still has very high approval ratings. And it's kind of interesting that the protests on Sunday were directed against Medvedev, ostensibly. That was the main rallying cry, was demanding answers about corruption by Medvedev. And even though there was some anti-Putin sentiment there, it's not a fact that that this younger generation that kind of showed up for the first time, it's not a fact that they all hate Putin. As a matter of fact, It could be the opposite, that they like Putin more than their predecessors in the opposition movement. And here it's kind of, there's kind of two things going on, I think. One is that Putin gets a lot of the credit for the foreign policy successes that Russia has had recently, while Medvedev takes a lot of the blame for the internal problems, including corruption, including bad roads, including police violence, all of these things. I mean, Medvedev is the head of the government, and he answers for all of that, technically, and he gets the blame for that. Also, Putin here is seen as someone who has really lifted the nation off its knees, as someone who has made Russia proud again, made Russia respected and feared around the world again. So he gets a lot, Putin gets a lot of love for that. And also this kind of Russian idea that there's a good Tsar and he's surrounded by bad boyars. In other words, there's a good king and he's just surrounded by bad officials. And if only he knew about all the problems in the country, he would, of course, solve them, but he just can't be everywhere at once and he can't solve everything. As to your question about whether Navalny could theoretically win the presidential election next year, I don't think that's really what anybody is thinking is going to happen. I think the fact that he's trying to run is going to prompt some sort of confrontation, and that's going to either lead towards protests, let's say when Navalny is locked up and not allowed and not put on the ballots, or something else. It's hard to say, but there's definitely some sort of tension and conflict that hasn't been resolved and will come to a head before the presidential election.
All right, Alec Loon, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Alec is a Moscow-based journalist with The Guardian. And in just a few minutes, we're going to talk about the Trump administration's plans to combat ISIS and recent attacks in Mosul. New York Times correspondent Rukmini Callimachi will join us for that. Keep it here. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It's been nearly 2 weeks since American military airstrikes destroyed an entire city block in Mosul's Jadida neighborhood. As many as 200 civilians died in the strike, which was part of a months-long effort to liberate Mosul from the grip of ISIS. We're going to get an update on what's happening in Jadida and also look at how American military strategy in Iraq is evolving under the Trump administration. As we are joined by New York Times correspondent Rukmini Callimachi. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
So, Rukmini, one resident of Mosul, Jadida, told the New York Times that the devastation reminds him of Hiroshima. Tell us about Jadida.
So what we know so far is that a coalition airstrike took out, as you noted, almost an entire city block. Of course, they believed that there were ISIS fighters hiding there, but there were instead dozens, if not hundreds, of civilians who have now been killed.
So scores were trapped in the rubble. Rescue efforts have freed some. Week and a half in, are there rescue efforts still, or is it primarily recovery?
At this point, I think it's primarily recovery from the reporting that I'm seeing from my colleagues on the ground.
Investigators also found that at least one building had collapsed in the immediate days following the strike. There was speculation, Rukmini, that ISIS might have blown the building up, killing civilians. What are you hearing? What's the latest on this?
I don't think that there's an answer regarding that particular building. But what we do know is that the fight for Mosul, which began last October, so it's now really entering its 6 month, has just recently entered the most treacherous and difficult part of the fight. And that's because they have now entered the old city of Mosul. The old city is a web of tiny alleys, small streets, too small really for Humvees and other large vehicles to pass through. It's also very difficult to pinpoint airstrikes here because the buildings are fragile. So if you might be aiming for one building, but the concussion of the strike is likely to take out a larger area. And now we're really in a debate about the rules of engagement. Under the Obama administration, the rules of engagement were extremely strict and conservative, specifically because the administration was trying to avoid a situation like this one. the Trump administration is denying that they have loosened the rules. They have strongly said that the rules have not changed, but that is not what we're hearing from Iraqi officials on the ground. They're saying that it's much easier to call them airstrikes now than it was even a few months ago.
Well, and my understanding too is there was some sense that Iraqi military forces were frustrated by the cautious approach of the Obama administration. What have you heard?
That was certainly what they said to me when I was last in Mosul and when I covered other battlefields in the fight against the Islamic State, including in Syria. So their complaint is that they would call in what they believe to be an ISIS position, and they would then be subjected to a barrage of questions by the coalition, including, are you taking enemy fire from that position, yes or no? If the answer is no, then the airstrike might not be approved. And in one instance, I was visiting with a Kurdish commander who was then at the front line before Mosul in the town of Bashika. This is back in 2015. And he actually showed me a video that he had shot on his cell phone of four men in the distance who arrive very close to his military camp and who begin digging a hole in the ground and who are seen laying something in the ground and and covering it up with dirt. So in his interpretation, they were lying, they were placing an IED at the base of his camp so that his men would be killed when they came out. And he said that he called and called, and the coalition kept saying to him, are you taking enemy fire? And he said, no, but it's an IED. It's going to explode when my men come out. And he claims that the coalition did not take the strike, and that he and his men therefore were no longer able to use that road because they didn't know how to defuse the bomb. So these are the complaints that you heard. In the wake of what's happened in the last 2 weeks, you do have to, I think, ask the question whether these more restrictive rules, had some wisdom to them.
Yeah. Well, give us an estimate, if you will, of how many civilians, how many hundreds of thousands of civilians, is that a correct estimate, are, as your colleague Tim Arango describes, are pinned down in sections of Western Mosul?
You know, I don't have a good estimate on that. What we know is that the city of Mosul, after it fell to ISIS, had an estimated population of 1 million. Half of the city was liberated in January. So just for the sake of argument, let's say that 500,000 were liberated. But the old city, which is on the western side of Mosul, the fight for that only began at the end of February and early March. So by now, you would think that still several hundred thousand more are most likely pinned down.
When civilians die, how might this shape the view that those who live in the region have of America, even as the U.S. is trying to help liberate Mosul? What are you hearing?
Well, the problem is the Islamic State has been using the trope of airstrikes and of airstrikes killing civilians, and specifically of U.S. airstrikes killing civilians, as one of the main ingredients in the propaganda. I have actually interviewed young people who were radicalized and went so far as to try to join the terror group from America after being shown images of dead Iraqi and Syrian children. Now, what is unfair about that is the Islamic State often lies in this regard. I have actually caught them sharing images of the Bhopal gas tragedy. This is a gas accident that happened in India decades ago.
Yeah.
I happen to know that image because it was taken by a friend of mine who was the photographer on assignment there at the time. And it's a picture of a little boy whose eyes are dilated because of the gas, and he's being put in the ground to rest by his family. And I saw them sharing that image on their private channels and claiming that it was a recent airstrike by the U.S. In Iraq. But they're falsely inflating the number of civilian casualties that are killed by the U.S. But when you have an incident like this one, where it's clear that it was the coalition that did indeed kill these civilians, then you can only imagine that this helps their propaganda and helps their worldview that that the U.S. Is out to kill Muslims.
And ISIS had also earlier used the caution of the Obama administration regarding civilian safety to its advantage. Fighters would use children as human shields?
That's that's the great irony. So ISIS is acutely aware of the Obama administration's rules of engagement, and now even the Trump administration's rules of engagement, because they do deny that the rules have been loosened. I can cite one example that my colleague Adam Goldman reported on, and that's the case of Junaid Hussein. He's a British member of ISIS, a former British hacker who ran away to the Islamic State and became one of their most important online recruiters and online insiders of violence. For months and months, the U.S. was hunting him, and he somehow knew that they would not hurt him if he was in the presence of his stepson. His stepson was, I think, 11, 12 years old. So he was always going outside, accompanied by this child, making it impossible for the U.S. to take the strike. They finally killed him on the one time that he somehow slipped out without taking the child with him. So that shows to you that they are well aware, you know, that the presence of children, the presence of women, protects them. Another example is Abu Muhammad al-Adnani. He was the spokesman of ISIS, and by some accounts, he was probably the second most important leader inside the Islamic State. We believe he's the person who was the mastermind behind the Paris attacks, the Brussels attacks, mm-hmm. the attacks in external territories. And they were of course tracking him for months and months. And when they finally killed him, it turned out that part of the time he had been hiding in essentially a large residential building in Raqqa. Hmm. So a building not unlike the ones that have now been struck, that was chocker blocks full of civilians, yeah. Because he knew that despite the propaganda that they put out, that the coalition actually is quite careful about striking civilian targets.
So, Rukmini, does this recent airstrike then indicate a change regarding this caution, this former caution from the Obama administration, in your mind?
So, Mary, we don't know for sure. The Trump administration is adamantly denying that there has been a change. However, the interviews that my colleague Tim Marengo did recently with Iraqi officials suggest that perhaps something has changed. The Iraqi officials are saying that whereas before they would call things in, they wouldn't see a reaction, or they would call things in and there'd be a debate about whether the target was valuable. Now they're seeing their calls being taken immediately, and action being taken on the heels of that.
So Eastern Mosul has essentially been liberated, correct?
Correct, yes.
What does Eastern Mosul look like today? Has ordinary life of sorts resumed for residents there?
So I was last in Eastern Mosul in the first week of March, and I was there pretty much every week for about a month before then. Eastern Mosul, in my opinion, looks remarkably good, given that it was just liberated at the end of January. So I even shot a video in one street. You can see that about a third of the shops appear to be open. There's vegetable sellers outside, you know, hawking tomatoes. There's restaurants that are open. The shop that is selling air conditioning units is open. Women are walking around without their veil. But there is still an ISIS presence, and I can give you one example that is somewhat personal to me. When I was there in my first week, this is in February, my team had packed power bars and, you know, tuna cans because we expected that we would leave our hotel in an area that was several hours away from Eastern Mosul, and that we wouldn't get back till evening, and that there wouldn't be anywhere to eat, you know, in the middle of the day. Yeah. We thought that we wouldn't be able to leave our cars, and instead we got to Eastern Mosul. And in my estimation, it looked fine. And I asked my translator if we could go to a restaurant. He found us a lovely restaurant. It's called. It's actually a famous Mosuli restaurant called My Fair Lady. And when we got there, the security advisor for the New York Times, who was with us, was visibly on edge. And he and I had a discussion about whether we should go inside. He didn't want to go inside. He finally agreed, but he wanted to leave the driver with the car. So we went into the restaurant and we had a lovely meal. There were children running around. There were couples holding hands. And literally 3 days later, a suicide bomber walked into that very restaurant and blew it up. And I know that it was where I was sitting because I saw a YouTube video that was shot by one of the patrons of the restaurant, and I saw the table that we were sitting on flying into the air.
So,
and so this is Eastern Mosul. This is a place that in some ways looks normal, but that clearly still has an ISIS infiltration problem.
So Rukmini Kolomaji, just a personal question for a moment. How do you deal with this? This as part of your profession as a journalist who is covering this story?
Well, in that moment and in several others, I realized that my threat assessment was off. You know, I realized that areas that I thought were safe are actually not. And so more and more I rely on my team to guide the way for me.
So more American soldiers are on their way to Iraq, is that correct?
I believe more. There's already quite a few. When I was with the 9th Armored Division of the Iraqi military, there was a U.S. Army base that was basically on the same campus as the 9th Armored Division, and I saw the U.S. colonel and the captain coming to have regular discussions with their Iraqi counterparts. They followed us out on the day that we went on our embed, and they were holding back. So from what I could tell, they really were playing an advisory role, which is what has been argued as what they're doing. What we're hearing is that they're going to be sending more troops to Syria to help with the fight against Raqqa.
Yeah. Well, and to Syria for just a moment, the battle, of course, around Raqqa, the self-declared capital of the so-called Islamic State. If Mosul and Raqqa are retaking, what is your observation? What does this do to ISIS? Anything close to a death blow?
Definitely not a death blow, but also not an insignificant blow. Territory is crucial and very important to ISIS because it is through territory and through holding territory that they make money. Their main form of income right now is not what people imagine. On my Twitter timeline, I'm always getting tweets from people who try to argue that ISIS is being funded by Saudi Arabia or by other Gulf countries. That's not the case. ISIS is self-funded, and they're self-funded much like America and Canada are self-funded, mainly by taxing the people that are under their control. So in all of these areas where they hold land, they also hold people who have to pay them a tax on their harvest, a tax on their businesses, a tax on what they sell. And so by taking away that territory, it'll make it harder for them to have revenue. And without revenue, it's harder to pay fighters, it's harder to build weapons, etc. But as Eastern Mosul shows, and really every area that has been liberated from ISIS up to now, including in Libya, including in Hasaka province in Syria, where I was in 2015, what we see is that areas are declared liberated, and not even weeks later, suicide bombings begin anew. And so the problem of the sleeper cells is something that that we need to grapple with, and the problem of a reinfiltration of an insurgency-like group taking hold again is something that is surely in the future.
Rukmini Kolomaji, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you. My pleasure.
Rukmini Kolomaji is a correspondent for The New York Times. Don't forget to visit our Facebook page and check out our podcasts. Simply head to whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nouri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and today for Marty Moskowain, thanks for joining us for Radio Times.